Morning.
Yes. My name's Scott. This is Rob. I only have the taller chair because I'm going first. We're going to do a tag team thing today. We don't know if it'll work. We may end up contradicting one another. But we're going to try it and we'll see what happens. We had this idea of talking about art and worldview. And so we're going to give this a shot. I get 15, 20 minutes and he gets 15, 20 minutes. I have notes to keep me from going too long. And I just want to start out by saying art is communication. Oh, we're on this side. Do you have no port on the other side?
No.
Whoopsie. Okay. We're good. We'll see if I can avoid tripping on that.
We're not up there yet.
Okay. What's that? Okay. Well, I'll just start by saying the way that I've always looked at art is that art is communication, and it's like a conversation with another person who you may or may not agree with. And that's a good thing. And when you're having a conversation with somebody else, you would like for them not to lie to you. And so I don't have a problem with an artist expressing something that he feels is true that I don't happen to think is true. And we see that a lot in art. But as communication, it gives us a historical record of what people thought and believed in the past. So I am going to sprint through three examples. First, I'm going to compare two of the greatest painters in history. Actually, I'm going to stand up if you don't mind me pacing. As a backdrop, let's go to the first slide. Okay, this is just briefly, quickly. This is 6th century in a chapel, a basilica in Ravenna, Italy. And all I want to say about this is that is a depiction of the emperor in the center, Emperor Justinian. This mosaic is flanked by a mural of his wife on the other side, who was sort of a co-ruler with her, as I understand it. And what I want you to notice is there's the military on the left, the emperor in the middle, the clergy on the right. And this seems to be about communicating power, uniformity, and order. And I don't think this guy wasn't all bad. He reestablished Orthodox Christianity in Ravenna over Arianism, which was a false teaching. He probably did that with the military. I don't really know the history. But the point is, we see this fusion of church and state throughout most of Christendom, and I think it's one of the most grievous errors in the history of the church, is this marriage of church and state. So first I'm going to go to, guess who? Can you pick out your favorite, most famous Roman Catholic artist? Yes, somebody said it right off the bat. Michelangelo. I never hear him called a Roman Catholic, but he painted the ceiling of the room where they choose popes, so I'm pretty sure he was Roman Catholic. This is an overview of the whole ceiling. In the middle, you see the creation story and so forth. In between these triangles, triangular shapes, you see a biblical prophet alternating with a pagan prophet or seer on the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel. And I think one of the most unfortunate things I have a particular interest in the history of the church, in the marriage of church and state, is this idea of a separation between Judaism and Christianity. An official separation was established very early on, and Judaism and Christianity are separate, but maybe more properly I should say a separation between Jews and Christians. Jews were theologically and systematically oppressed throughout most of history, which is why they were sort of chased all over Europe until very recently. So one of the things you see, in addition to the, a Christian painter painting pagan and Hebrew prophets kind of on an equal, with an equal importance. None of these guys, none of these Hebrew prophets really have anything to do with Judaism. You can see Daniel right there with the golden blonde hair. Next slide. This is just a picture of Prophet Jonah. You can see the big fish next to the Libyan Sibyl, who's one of the pagan prophets. Also, you see this famous statue. Whoopsie. David. Nope, that's too far. Too far. We want to see the quote first. So this is church, so I didn't put the whole statue of David. But there's this quote of David. Who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should mock, or that he should defy the armies of the living God? And now you can go to the next slide. It turns out David appears to be uncircumcised. And the fact that one of the greatest painters in Christian history can get away with painting the, Israel's most famous king, stark naked, uncircumcised, is kind of amazing, and it says something about this separation that occurred. There's a scholar I read that says that theologically, with the church, reached back and reimagined and reinterpreted the entire Jewish history so that all the patriarchs, kings, and prophets were actually Christian. So essentially, the church took everything away from Jews, everything good away from Jews, except for the curses that for disobedience in the Old Testament. You see this reflected here. Let's go to Rembrandt, just as a contrast. By the way, I'm not disputing Michelangelo's greatness as a painter, but just describing the water, I think. Rembrandt he lived right in this sweet spot. So he's a Reformation guy. He's soundly right in the Reformation. And I want to just talk about a quick timeline here. Just to give a point of reference, Sistine Chapel was completed, the painting was completed, 1512. Luther nails his 95 Theses to the church door. In 1570, just a few years later, Tyndale is executed for heresy. A few years after that, Mayflower sets sail, 1620. I mention that for reasons of religious freedom and the reason they did that. And so Rembrandt's right around the time the Mayflower would have set sail in his lifetime. So that's kind of cool to think about. So check out this. This is a Byzantine face of Jesus. That's Michelangelo's face of Jesus from the Last Judgment. And then go to the next one. That's Rembrandt's face of Jesus. And you can see an obvious difference there, right? He's like a human being. I think that's a compassionate face. He looks like a real guy. And it's not an idealized figure. Go to the next slide, please, if you don't mind just doing that for me. Then I'll stand over here. This is Michelangelo's depiction of Adam. Obviously, an idealized figure, sort of godlike. Kind of looks like he could beat up God if he wanted to. And go to the next slide. This is Rembrandt's depiction of Adam and Eve. They're just like these lumpy, frizzy people, right? And so he's almost anti-idealized, the way he paints people. Go to the next one, please. This is one of my favorite prints. These are etchings of his. This is one of my favorite prints, Christ preaching. And you see these normal people, including women, sitting around. Some are skeptical, some are resistant. In the foreground, you see a mother with a baby, a nursing baby, and a little kid on the ground doing what little kids do in church, which is drawing in the dirt or whatever. And then go to the next one. This is Jesus and the woman at the well. So I meant to mention the previous one with Christ's teaching. There is a halo above Jesus, but it's not emitting light. It's just kind of like, oh yeah, this guy is divine right here. Guy speaking. Here there's no halo, so it's like he's wrestling with the idea: how do I depict a representational depiction of Jesus, and indicate his divinity somehow? Right. So he did the halo, the previous one. Also compositionally, he's prominent. Here he's just talking to this woman. He has no halo. He just looks like a man. But so look where he signs his name, right here, where the ellipse of the well connects. He's left that blank and he signs his name there. I think that's an excuse to sort of cheat. And it looks like he's in the well. Like, do you get that? And what is he saying to the woman? What is this discourse? He's gesturing to himself, basically saying he is the source of the living water that he's talking to this woman about. So it's a picture of him sort of claiming divinity. So anyway, I just want to say one other thing about Rembrandt. He lived in Amsterdam much of his life. He bought a house, maybe two houses, in the Jewish quarter. He lived in close proximity to the Jewish people. He painted something like 140 portraits during his lifetime, and over a quarter of those were Jewish people who commissioned him. So he's known as a friend of the Jews. I just think that's cool. It's an interesting contrast. Okay, then I'm going to switch gears. I forgot to set my timer. I'm going to set this for 7 minutes. And now I want to switch gears and answer the question that we've all asked. Why is this painting in a museum? My 5-year-old could have painted that. Okay. And this first slide, by the way, I'm not being critical of these paintings I'm about to talk about. I like a lot of these artists and paintings. I'm just again, hopefully just describing the water. But what I'm gonna share with you, I'd never heard in art school. I went to a private art college, so did my wife. That's where we met. And all I heard when it came to paintings like this in modern art is stuff like this caption. The painting's use of lines, ambiguous shapes, and space all demonstrate the principles of Klee's artistry in which simple graphical elements are, quote, set in motion by the energy of the artist's mind. And that doesn't really tell me anything. My wife and I call this art speak. It's this flowery language that doesn't really say anything, because I don't think half the time people don't get it anyway. But anyway, let's go to the next slide. This is just sort of to set up the issue that I'm talking about. So we got two painters. They're basically painted at the same time. 1874, the other one's 1889. Leon Bonnet, Paul Gauguin. It looks like in the 19th century, around the end of the 19th century, that painters suddenly forgot how to paint. And again, I'm not being critical. There's some cool things about this painting, but the comparison there is pretty stark. This is amazingly refined and rendered, whereas this is much more childlike, right? Next slide, please. This is another example. If I didn't have the name up there, you would never guess this was a Picasso, right? But look at this. It's called Science and Charity. Science is represented by the doctor. Charity is represented by the nurse with this dying woman, painted in 1897 when he was 15 years old. Okay, next slide. Okay, that's what he's known for. When you think of Picasso, you don't think of Science and Charity, you think of Guernica, right? So the point is, obviously, this is a conscious choice, because he's capable of that first thing that I just showed you, but he makes his career doing this. So what's going on? There's another timeline I'm going to give you real quick. I should have made a slide of it, but I didn't. But The 19th century, the world was changing again in a big way. 1839, cell theory was introduced. 1848, Communist Manifesto came out. 1859, Origin of Species. Freud coins the term psychoanalysis in 1896. We're getting toward the end of the century. And a lot of that had to do with childhood. And going back to childhood, which is kind of a relatively new idea. And this all overlapped with the Victorian era. So during this time period, there emerged a widespread interest across, you know, all the European countries in children's art. And it wasn't because it was cute, as that they were looking to children's art for something. This corresponded with, don't go there yet. This corresponded yet with increasingly enlightenment thinking and less of a reliance on revelation, more of a looking to science and humanism. But it was particularly in the arts that this idea of children's art was being explored. And several art movements, expressionism, cubism, futurism, fauvism, other art movements, all hung children's art with their work when they exhibited. I never heard this in art school. And sometimes there were even exhibits of just children's art that masses of people would come to. I never heard this in art school. This is like a key to understanding modern art. Many of the greatest 19th century, 20th century artists had huge collections of children's art. The author of the book where I got most of this from went to the families and got access to their files, and it's like they were avid collectors of children's art. So why? What was going on? Well, the reasons vary. There was a disillusionment with the layers upon layers of European, Victorian social mores, tradition, expectations, religion. So some were seeking authenticity. They saw this other way of painting as pretentious. Some were seeking a more universal language. Everyone has a childhood. Everyone made kids' art when they were little. Some are hoping to connect on a more primal level or more inner level with people. Interested in bypassing cultural conventions. And there's this idea that comes along with it that's really in conflict with the scriptures. It has this, gives us this idea of fallenness, that what is natural equates to what is good. And whatever is like a part of nature is higher. And you can kind of see evolutionary thinking creeping in here. And so they saw children as sort of closer to nature, uncorrupted, almost like they had some of the secrets that we get, you know, trained out of us with civilization and all the things that are put on us, religion, morality, that sort of thing. And so that's what they were doing. They were actually, the reason it looks like your five-year-old could have painted that is because these guys were imitating five-year-olds. And, okay, next slide. Here's a couple examples. Paul Klee, on the left, is the actual artist. This is a child's drawing from his friend Kandinsky's collection. That's like a direct rip from the kids' art. So I'll finish up here quickly. But I don't know if you can see that from where you are, but he's taking this idea and exploring, you know, trying to get inside the kid's mind. Okay, next slide. I'll just do one more. I'm not sure the source of that child's drawing, but that's Paul Klee. I don't know if he used that as a direct source or not. But, and a lot of other times, it's not so much that they're ripping an idea literally, but it's just more the idea of how kids conceive a visual space. If they're conceiving anything, maybe they just don't know how to draw stuff. But anyway, that's my personal opinion. Anyway, let's look at some quotes and sum up here. So these are actual painters from that era describing what they're thinking. And I should mention, there's a more, they're referring to primitivism here. They saw children as sort of domestic primitives, sort of unspoiled, uncorrupted, you know, local primitives that we can sort of look at. He said, you will always find vital sap coursing through the primitive arts. In the arts of an elaborate civilization, I doubt it. Paul Gauguin, who left his family to live in Tahiti, and that is putting it charitably. Next one. This guy, Jean Dubuffet, I would not want to live inside this guy's head. I personally have a very high regard for the values of primitive peoples. Instinct, passion, capri, violence, madness. Nor do I feel that these values are in any way lacking in our Western world. He has a point there. On the contrary, but the values celebrated by our culture do not strike me as corresponding to the true dynamics of our minds. Again, this idea that if it's not naturally something that we're inclined to do, it's probably like fake or inauthentic. And God forbid that we submit to that idea. His friend, poet Andre Michaud, says, I paint to decondition myself. So you can kind of see what they're doing here. Next slide, please. This is that first guy, Jean Dubuffet. Creative invention has surely no greater enemy than social order, with all the appeals to adapt, to conform, to mimic, which social relationships imply. Jean Dubuffet, founder of the movement Art Brut, which means raw or art or outsider art. Sometimes they would display works of the mentally ill, what they called the insane at the time, also along with children and primitive arts. And you can think of other of Picasso's works where you see the influence of primitive art, African art, in their so-called primitive art. So, just to sum up, this is a conversation, right? And we're a few decades away now from this and these guys, and we can see a world still struggling with trying to understand the shape of reality. I contend that God's revelation gives us a true picture of man, of God, and of how to navigate our world, and I thank God for that. I think I'll leave it at that and hand off to Rob.
Picasso achieved universal renown and immense fortune for his revolutionary artistic accomplishments and became one of the best known figures in the 20th century. And it's kind of confusing because most people, when they first see like a Picasso, they kind of go like what? Like, what is this and what does it mean? You know, and how does this come about, and how did we get here? And as Scott was talking about this really a degradation of humanity and the human form and the individual, how it becomes debased and it's almost like we're worthless. It's almost nihilistic, atheistic, humanistic. Anything but God seems to be acceptable when they start getting to this point. And Pablo is right at the forefront of it. But first I wanted to look at a picture. It's not up here yet, but it's the woman of Algiers in their apartment, or a harem. And a harem in the Muslim world was a room or an apartment or somewhere in the house that was just for the women of the household. That's what it is. This Delacroix, who paints this picture we're going to put up here, he is in this area somewhere between classical and romantic art, and he, and you can really see like the beginning of the, in the change of styles, and you see him leaning a bit to this idea of romanticism. And here is the harem, and we have three Muslim women. It's in Algeria. Delacroix was a Frenchman. Algeria was a colony. He decided to go there and visit. He went and took sketches, lots and lots of sketches, and when he got back to France, he painted his paintings. And this one here is just, you can see that there's a, it's highly romanticized. Everything is pleasant. Everything is pleasing. Even the slave girl here is seems fine. The women are a little more robust. Their clothing is flowing and beautiful and attractive, and they have a hookah there, and their sandals are off, and they're in the comfort of their harem, and no men can come into there. And that's where they do their talking. It's just a really wonderful painting, and just really well done, and the colors, it's bright, it's beautiful, the lighting, everything about it's fantastic. And Picasso, in the 1950s, started looking at these classical paintings. And this one particularly, he particularly struck him, and he says, I'm gonna paint one of these too. Woman of Algier, Picasso. Looks just like it. I don't know what to say. And yet, this is the most expensive painting ever bought. Anyone take a guess? Guys, shout out anything. $400 million? You're not that far off, really. $280 million, including the fees that were involved. $280 million that sold for. But who was Picasso? And I think kind of need to look at this a little bit. This is from a book, Picasso, My Grandfather, by Marina Picasso. He submitted them to his animal sexuality, tamed them, bewitched them, ingested them, and crushed them onto his canvas. After he had spent many nights extracting their essence, once they were bled dry, he would dispose of them. That's what Picasso thought of women. And you see that throughout his artwork. He takes a harem where women are lounging and relaxing and being together, enjoying each other's company, and he turns it into a brothel. That's just the way he thought about women. And it's throughout his work. It's incredible. These are quotes here from Picasso himself. Women are machines for suffering. For me, there are only two kinds of women, goddesses and doormats. That's him. He's a pretty repugnant person. I don't mean to be too judgmental, and I don't want to denigrate his art too much either, because there's some things I see that he does, I kind of like it. That wasn't one of them, but some I do. And when I tell you, oh, here's one I like, you're going to go, what's wrong with Rob? So, and that's the thing about art. It is subjective, very much so. And everybody has their likes and their dislikes. There's really not anything in the Bible that tells us that art is bad and you shouldn't look at art. Matter of fact, really kind of contrary, for the whole temple itself was filled with art. Just beautiful pieces made of gold and silver and jewels, but all that was in some way some sort of a picture of what God was like and what it is that he wants us to know and worship and honor. But for Picasso, it just isn't quite that way. Ma Jolie, my pretty girl, is also known as Woman with a Guitar. Anybody see the guitar? Anybody see a person? Anybody see anything? And yet, I like this. I do, but not because of what it is. If he just called it a, you know, angles and shading in gray, I would think, that really describes this picture well, and I kind of like it. But Ma Jolie, my pretty girl? I don't think so. Not going with it. But it's actually a portrait of his first mistress, who, after he left her for a Russian ballerina, had a nervous breakdown. Girl Before a Mirror, 1932, we're progressing through his life here with his loves. Maria Therese Walter. She was a mistress. She committed suicide when he died. She committed suicide, it was later on. She was 17 when he began to have an affair with her. He was married at the time, he was 45, and he was married to this Olga Koklova, who was a ballerina, a prima ballerina in Russia. He went to Russia for a while. He was with this Eva, and then he met her and got married. She was a ticket for him because she was really big in society in Russia, and so she had all kind of contacts and all things kind of going on. And man, that was it. But here's this is his mistress, and then she's looking at herself in the mirror, and it's kind of poignant in a way. She seems to be an attractive young girl, but she looks in the mirror and she sees herself as grotesque. But just the whole thing is just different. It's just something that you don't expect. Olga, his wife, he divorced her. He didn't divorce her. She wanted a divorce. She found out about this particular affair. She wanted wouldn't divorce him because she wanted to divorce him, but he would not have it because he'd have to split his fortune with her. So he left her. he left her married and not able to do anything, and then continued on in life. His next mistress, Dora Maar, beautiful, isn't she? Just the total debasement of women. Grotesque. She also committed suicide. He did marry again, Jacqueline Roque. When he passed away, she committed suicide, as did his grandson and one of his sons. And the world loved him. I don't know if they understood his art. I don't know if they even cared. But that's what he felt about women. He was a communist. He was a misogynist. He was kind of a loathsome person. He would be generous with his money in certain particular areas or things. But his art spoke a lot, more than we think. Now, you may not have known any of the stories behind this, but art speaks to us, and artists try to convey to us what they're thinking, what's going on. During the Korean War, being a communist, he despised that the United States was involved in the Korean War, so he decided to paint a picture of the American atrocities during the Korean War. It's just not true. But there it is. It's saying something. Slaughtering infants, children, pregnant women, heavily armored, swords, guns, or whatever those things are in his mind. So Picasso is a product of the world, created by various philosophers, filtering down to the intellectuals, going into the universities. And the artists, Scott had mentioned this, I thought there was a really good way of saying it, are always ahead on the curve. Before we're even thinking about it, they're painting about it. They've been taught it in the universities, in the schools, they've been brought up in it, and that's what they do. They paint it. They have a story to tell. And it's a story of humanity, and it's a story that is outside of a God, and it's ugly. Probably somebody you never heard of, Stanley Whitney. He was born in Philadelphia in 1946. He now lives and works in New York City and Eastern Long Island, New York. He holds a BFA from Kansas City Art Institute, as well as an MFA from Yale University, and is currently Professor Emeritus of Painting and Drawing at Tyler School of Art, Temple University. Well credentialed. You think, man, this guy probably has a lot going for him.
I was going to say, yeah, Kansas City Art Institute, that's where Molly and I went. I don't know what you're about to say about this guy.
We're going to look at his next painting called The Freedom We Fight For. And this is recent. He painted this just this year. And this is how this is described by a critic. His signature color block style, which he frequently refers to as his mature style, did not emerge until the early 1990s while he was living in Rome. It was at this time that the collision of space and color came to fore of his work, inspired by interactions with Rome's classical architecture. And you're thinking, wow, this has got to be something. I don't know what you learned at your school, Scott. And neither did he.
Wow. He had a different professor.
That sold for $2.5 million.
I'd do it for $1 million. I'd do it for $5.
I'm still trying to see the classic Roman style, but that's okay. Forget about it. The title refers and The title refers to the time we're living in, a time when human rights are under attack in our country, in this country. To that end, now this is somebody else speaking. To that end, Whitney chose Planned Parenthood of Greater New York for its work in providing reproductive health care, like abortion, but also for its family planning services. In addition, he chose the Art Justice Fund to recognize the staggering number of imprisoned people in the United States, which outranks any other country. They're both fantastic organizations that I've supported in the past, and the work they're doing is critical at this time. I always title all of my work so that if you didn't see the painting, you would still have a sense of who I am and where I come from. The art is just the front for him to be able to shock you and then try and go to your sensibilities about what it is you should be supporting. One more work of quote unquote art, untitled. You can't make this stuff up. I always title my work. Oops, this one's untitled. This is a color etching, 28 3/4 by 35 1/2. It's a part of an edition of 20. And you can buy this, it's available. Bryson, get your checkbook ready, because this is a deal. $9,500, it's yours. And I don't even know what to say about it because he doesn't give it a name. So I don't, yeah, I just, and the smudges up here. And as Scott had shown earlier about what the children's work, this is right there. That's finger painting at its best. And he used a brush. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth and unrighteousness, because that which is known about God is evident within them. For God made it evident to them. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes, his eternal power, and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, and so that we are without excuse. For even though they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks, but they became futile in their speculations, and their foolish heart was darkened. Professing to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the incorruptible God for an image in the form of the corruptible man and of birds and four-footed animals and crawling creatures. Therefore God gave them over in their lust of their hearts to impurity, so that their bodies would be dishonored among them, for they exchanged the truth of God for a lie and worshiped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever. Amen. I spoke harshly. Trying not to be judgmental and say, well, this is who they are, or this is where they're going to go, or this is what they did. They are men of their times. Right about the time when, just before Nazi Germany came up, the world was in an unbelievable turmoil, especially in Europe. Everything was degraded. Everything was falling apart. Germany had its underground houses where they danced and drank and whatever. You know, the Spain had their fascist groups that were rising. The Nazis were rising. France was just a pit of sin, debased, foul, whatever you could imagine. And this is where everything begins to come out of. This is where all the art, all the thoughts, all the philosophies, everything of humanity just is begins to think is coming to like a you think it's a peak, and it kind of is a peak, because after that it gets even worse. It goes downhill. The things that are going on in the world today are just crazy. And at one time, this nation of ours was one nation under God. And you can't even mention God in school anymore. I'm not saying art is the cause of it. I'm saying that art is the symptom of it. And I love some of this stuff, really, as far as art for art's sake. Art's not bad. Bad people do art. And so do good people. But there was a time when it was almost all art in the Western world had a Christian significance to it. And now, it's hard to find a Christian artist that's doing anything meaningful. We're fortunate we have two in our body that produce works, abstracts, plein air. Scott and Molly. Scott has one piece I absolutely love. I mean, and he won't sell it. but it's from a time when he was in Germany, and there's an outdoor patio, and there's kind of a canvas or tent kind of, and the lighting, it's just incredible. I fell in love with it immediately, and I said, "Well, how much is that?" And he says, "What a horrible artist! You'd never be a Picasso." I'm sure. Now, there you go. I have learned something new today, and I'm happy about that. It does my soul good to hear that people want to create for God. But we're in the end times. Of course, we've been in the end times since Jesus went up to heaven. But it's getting worse. And it was pretty debased back then, but now it's... at least there was a sense of civility at times, but not so much anymore. And Scott had created this idea. I mean, he said, "I like those things that you did. I think we could really do something together." And I said, "Yeah, let's go for it." So it's different. And I do hope you enjoyed it. I hope that you got something from it. And I hope that, as we talked about this morning, that we don't have to feel hopeless with what's going on.
So can I ask a question before we close on that? Do we have time?
Yes, real quick.
So I'm just curious. So, I mean, we're talking about how we see it debasing now in our society, which we can see. But like Roman times, I mean, you had slavery, you have stuff. So how are we, I mean, it feels like we can kind of see that in this art, but how do we see that in the past? Like how, I mean, because in the Roman art, I'm assuming we'd see the same thread, because mankind hasn't changed. Is that true? So, I mean, what are the examples in the past? Because I know there's a lot of good stuff in the past, but is there, like, a lot of that stuff that I missed? Or, I don't, I'm not an artist, so that's my question, because it seems like we're focusing on modern times, but what was in the past, and how did that influence that? Does that make sense?
We were trying to go more with along the line of how we went from Christian art and the glorification of God and Christ to where we are to kind of today. Mm-hmm. Was Rome debased and bad and horrible things happening? Yeah, it certainly was. But their art was, most of their art was either mosaics or sculpture.
Okay.
All right, because they didn't have, I don't know of any extant paintings from that period at all, and then when they did begin to paint, everything was flat, like two-dimensional. So they didn't have those abilities. Eventually, got better and better and better, and continued on and on. But what the main idea is, like, art speaks to us, and it tells us something, and the artists have something that they're trying to tell us, and most of that has to do with what filters down. The philosophers back then were Aristotle, Plato, Socrates, and now we have probably 20,000 philosophers in the world, maybe more, not counting us armchair ones. So then our modern day, you're going to have to get me afterwards.
Yeah, the last one is modern day art. Which ones, is there modern day arts that are actually positive? That is a good one to look at.
Anything could be a good one to look at. All right, and that's what I'm saying. Art is subjective. Something you might say, you might have looked at that one painting and said, wow, that's pretty cool. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking like, that's not even painting. But but it's hard, like we're trying not to say that the art is good, the art is bad. Art is what it is, it's art. And it's telling a story, and it's also in music, same thing. It's been debased, it's come down to meaningless things, literature, streams of consciousness, writing, it's sculpture, it's movies, it's photography, it's all of it is goes in that direction. Is there good? Yes, there is. But what isn't is telling a story that debases God. Father, I thank you for this time. I thank you for this group of believers that that just love you and want to serve you. We talked about some hard things in history and where we are at now, the way people think. How little value is placed on human life. Pray that we would be beacons on a hill and quick with our tongues to present the truth. Thank you for this time. In Jesus' name, amen.